好不多。
他是我杀的。
Just happened.
No, you can get used to it. I'm sure it was just So yeah, shocking is okay.
You know, I was
okay. Let's get started again. Can we start recording on the phone service, please? Thank you. We've probably got a couple more people that have joined us today, so I think we'll just do another sort of roll call around the room for the purpose of the recording. So if you can just state your name and your role, whether you're here representing a constituency or whether you're an observer. My name is Bruce Tonkin and I'm chair of the committee on UGTLDs. Werner, if you'd like to just start off, just state your name.
My name is Werner Staub. I'm from CORE and working at committee as an observer. Max Corre, also with CORE and also observer.
Kurt Schwartz from ICANN staff has been registered liaison.
Derek Shepard, business constituency, member of the task force.
Mohamed Kishongo, GNS council member, non-commercial user constituency.
Brett Foster, at-large liaison.
Officer Yan Nam,
Carmel Pointy. Paul Knowling, I
can start from. Glenn Lucentovi, GNSS Secretariat. Denise Michelle, I can. That's for that purpose.
Liz Williams, Senior Policy Counselor in Brussels.
And Helen, I can
Dan Halloran, ICANN staff.
Marilyn Kay, business constituency.
And my commitment observer.
Johnny Holmes, ICPCP.
Rebecca, intellectual property constituency.
Ken Stubbs, registry constituency.
Chuck Gomes, registry constituency.
Ray Fassett, registry constituency.
Thank you all. What I thought I'd do just briefly is just recap where we got to yesterday and then just pick up the discussion again. So yesterday what we were doing is we were focusing on the current draft recommendations with respect to selection criteria and we're going through the various comments that we've received. And what we're trying to identify is we're trying to sort of move things from being minority or majority recommendations into the category of supermajority. We had a discussion around application fees. There was a lot of public feedback on that particular topic. And I've posted to the GTLD council mailing list kind of the outcome of that discussion yesterday. And that seemed to be basically that the principle would be that ICANN would recover its costs of evaluation from the application fees, that the fee will be set at the start of the process for the applicants. Some applications may cost different amounts to evaluate, therefore there may be different fees depending on the type of application. It is possible that applicants could pay different amounts depending on what stage in the process the application reaches, being the concept that there may be some initial first pass that an application goes through this particular fee for that, and if they get through the first pass then the second pass might have some additional fee. There was discussion about how to handle the issue that there, it may be desirable to encourage some diversity of applicants, particularly with respect to perhaps cultures or developing parts of the world. And so we suggested that ICANN should have a system of grants for applicants that would find cost recovery a barrier to entry. This grant would only allow the applicant to apply without any presumption that the application itself would be successful, and that these grant applications would go through an evaluation process. We weren't going to try to attempt to build that grant system, but merely suggest that such a system could be created by ICANN to deal with that specific issue as part of its general objectives in terms of outreach. And that ICANN should evaluate options for funding the grants, and there's no specific requirement that that funding come from the application fee process itself. There could be other sources of funding that ICANN could use for that. So that was pretty much the outcome of that discussion. I've posted that information to the GPLD list, and for those that have just joined us today, I'm currently broadcasting this screen via Shinkuru, so if you know how to use Shinkuru, you'll be able to see a copy of this screen being broadcast. The other large discussion was on the topic of differentiated namespace. There were quite a few comments on that, and the arrow on the screen is kind of representing that the comments seem to be away from the draft wording, and that we need to think about rewording that in such a way that we can get the majority support. The outcome of the discussion yesterday on that topic so far, and we'll pick that discussion up further, but the first part of the discussion was just focusing on the strings themselves, and that was that the GTLD string should not be confusingly similar to an existing GTLD string, and confusingly similar was defined as means there is a likelihood of confusion on the part of the relevant public, and that definition is taken from, I guess, trademark approaches in Europe. There was also suggested that a public comment process should be used to assist ICANN staff in making this determination. So this part A is basically that the staff would make a determination on whether or not a string being put forward was confusingly similar, and there'd be a public comment process to help them making that decision. We also set an example, or I guess it's a guideline really, is that a new GTLD proposal should avoid names that have the potential to confuse net users because they are typographically similar to variants of or derived words from existing GPLDs. And this is some of the wording that was used as part of the input into the original round of 2000 that was developed by one of the ICANN working groups. So we've just copied that wording. Then there was the concept that there should be a dispute resolution process using independent arbitrators. So in other words, not ICANN staff. Where an existing registered operator could challenge a decision made by the staff regarding whether or not a new GTLD string is confusingly similar to an existing GTLD string. And then finally, the view was if the string is successfully challenged as being misleadingly similar, then no operator may subsequently register, including an existing operator. So in other words, if for example you had someone put forward the string COMM, and that was challenged as being confusingly similar to COM, then the string COMM wouldn't be registered going forward. So that was basically the outcome of that discussion. Sure.
Under the discussion about go up one more. A public comment process should be used to assist ICANN staff in making this determination. I thought we also mentioned the idea that in making this determination in the trademark world, a panel of experts are used, people who are knowledgeable. Public comment is going to get us opinions, but not necessarily
any expert advice. So, are we...
Well, just the way I thought the process was separating that stage, which is input to staff. I'm assuming that staff would have engaged experts themselves directly. In other words, yeah, that would be a staff function. That doesn't mean it's existing staff. It could be they use an outside advisor or whatever, unless you want to strengthen that. I guess the question is not making that too heavyweight. And then having a dispute process that was more heavyweight, which would have a panel of judges and so on.
So we're looking at this is actually about the dispute process we talked about is merely limited to objection by the existing
auditor. Yeah, in the same way
this is actually a different point.
Yeah, it is a different point.
And it's a different part of the process where, let's say hypothetically that, heaven forbid, famous among them grandholders would decide that they want to have top-level names. It's a little confusing to the public, but so you might see names that are spelled with three letters or four letters. Clearly, in the trademark world, experts offer opinions on whether that or not those are confusing, not just public comments. This is limited to public comment. Now, that basically means we get opinions of random users who see this and respond to it. Given what's happened with Europe, I guess I am not confident that public opinion is the only thing that should be thought about in that stage of confusion.
Well, I'm just trying to separate decision from input, right? So when we say in a public comment process, that can be input from experts, it's not limited to someone that's not an expert. But what I'm trying to understand is who makes the decision? Is it an ICANN staff function to make that decision? Or are you, I mean, the other scenario, I suppose, is what we have in the registry services process. We have a standing panel of security experts that are on retainer from ICANN. And when a registry service is proposed and it has a security implication, that panel is used. That is a more expensive process, but if you feel that there's that level of expertise required, then...
Given that we're trying to do policy, which also is going to have implications for IDN, I do think that the idea that there needs to be some expertise besides the public, right now a public comment process, the way we operate it, is open to the public, but does not necessarily elicit expert opinion.
Yeah, that's a different thing, I agree. Yeah. So you're suggesting then that there's a panel used, some sort of standing expert panel.
Or that some sort of expertise is sought to augment this, and I'm thinking really primarily about how this is going to play out in the IDN
world. Yeah, and we should be thinking about that. So just to use the registry services as a precedent, the registry service process says that the first phase of the process, the staff may use their own experts. In other words, they might consult an expert, for example, in making a determination of whether they think there's a security issue or not. If the ICANN staff, this is a staff decision, think that there is the potential for a security issue, then the staff make a decision to forward it to a security panel. So that's kind of the flow that's used there. Is that a correct summary of that? Is that fair, Dan?
I guess that's sort of one, I mean, the point I think I made yesterday is that this is just one subset of the reasons why some people might object to a particular string.
Yeah.
We're also going to have, you know, if somebody proposes .localhost or .exe, it might not fit with the current string, but there's going to be people who have valid and technical reasons why that shouldn't be allocated.
Right.
So we're going to need to have a general process for vetting these streams for technical reasons, for confusing similarity, for, you know, maybe yesterday brand names was up there, somebody applies for .Microsoft or .Yahoo, and it's not Microsoft or Yahoo, there may be a problem there.
Right.
So I don't know if you want to drill down on how you sort out one particular kind of objection before we, without going through the whole range of possible business, right?
Well, I think that it's more kind of understanding what the process is, because I want to go into some of those other ones in a bit more detail.
Yeah, but you guys have
that. The same process should apply. It's a concept of really whether you're putting it down to, let's say it's the staff manager of the process, is it we're just putting it down on them? Are we suggesting that they put it to a panel if they think they're uncertain? I'm just trying to get a sense of the flow. We can just use the registry service process as a precedent and say that you'll have a first step where you have a look at it and there's nothing obvious, it's fine. If you're uncertain, you go to a panel.
And so, you know, for instance, compliance with existing RFC is about reserving names at the first and second level, things of that nature. They seem automatic if you know about them, but I'm not sure that all the task force members will have had a chance to think about something like .exe may vary. It may be the first name proposed, right? If you're familiar with the RFCs, you know that's an exclusion list.
So the process that you're talking about there, for streams, it's called string checks, is one, start with, staff will make a determination. So I just, firstly, there's a public comment,
right,
which is essentially the input phase, and there's the kind of decision phase.
Mm-hmm.
Staff will make a determination, engage appropriate expert advice, and then the next step is if staff think there may be an issue, then it is put to a standing panel.
Let me question the term standing, because if we're making a decision about an IDN in Chinese, the panel needs to have competency in that language and other languages perhaps. And I think it's going to be too expensive to have a standing panel retained in the way that we're retaining the security panel of every language in the world. But the concept of seeking appropriate expert advice based on the string that we're dealing with, particularly in IDNs, I think makes sense. It's the appropriate advice.
I want to just separate the getting advice can be just, you know, you're engaging in consult.
Right.
A panel's a little bit of a different concept.
Right.
A panel generally involves a number of experts in that field, and you're seeking a consent
to a panel with appropriate background or something of that nature. Because retaining a standing panel, I object to the over $1 million bill.
Yeah, most of us are concerned about that.
You know, I think this is going to vary so much on a case-by-case basis that there needs to be written pretty loosely so that we can get the correct amount of advice without being constrained to do something expensive.
Because I think the thing is that some of these things ultimately become subjective. And when if it's a straight technical thing, that's probably relatively simple. You know, ask the technical experts, they know that won't work and this is why, and that's simple. But a lot of the stuff gets a little bit more subjective when you're saying, you know, that is this going to be an issue, look similar, do you think so or not? That's where you kind of want to have a few people.
Yes, what happens when there's contest. And in trademark applications, the party who's trying to prove that they have use rights, et cetera, presents a fair amount of documentation. The check is that the process followed. So there's a process that the examiner is supposed to follow, and the check is that the process followed. So I think that, you know, in terms of thinking about the limitation of liability to ICANN for making these decisions or selections, we're going to have a process. And then the check is about, did you call the process?
Yeah. Yeah. All right, any other comments on it?
Bruce, just backing up a step or two here, are we envisioning a process whereby probably independent evaluators would take the first cut at whether or not there's sufficient evaluation, or differentiation, excuse me, and then there would be a comment period, and then the challenge process would kick in?
I think that's probably a better order of events, because what you probably want to do, and this is where we're kind of looking at, there may be a number of gates that an application goes through, and there potentially could be different fees as part of that. But one of the things that we talked about yesterday is you wouldn't want to be going through a $100,000 evaluation process, and then the last stage of that is usually a string conflict, because you've wasted huge amounts of resources in both organisations.
That's what I was trying to clarify.
We want to try and deal with this issue.
So this might be an upfront issue that's dealt with right at the beginning.
And I think that could be done in such a way that maybe in terms of again using registered service processes to some degree, there's the concept that a registry operator can approach ICANN with some degree of confidentiality and say, look, we're thinking of doing X, Y, and Z. And ICANN can go, yeah, well, we think that might be an issue. We're going to go and put it through this bigger process. Well, no, we don't think it's going to be an issue. Before you go, you stick your thing out in public and say you're going to build such and such a service. So I think there's some concept, if what I'm not hearing is right, is that you can put forward a string and then ICANN can confidentially say, no, we don't think that string's going to get up for whatever reason. Before it actually would go to a public comment process. Is that what you're envisioning?
Yeah, well, I wasn't thinking one way or another. I wanted clarity in terms of what the thought process was, especially since I wasn't here yesterday.
Yeah. No, we're going into a much more level of detail in this topic than we were yesterday. Yeah. Yesterday we just had the concept that there was a review process, and now we're doing that.
And then regarding Marilyn's comment with regard to public comments, I do believe that's an area where we want to be careful, because it does open up the door for people to just put any sort of comments forward, and then I think it puts ICANN staff or whoever's doing the evaluating in a very awkward position, because if they ignore the comments, they're criticized at the same time. Some of the comments, we know what happens, so we don't need to deal with the detail at this very moment, but I think that is something we should be cautious about.
May I just ask a point of clarification there? An open public comment period actually does do exactly what you've described, and it does set up all kinds of other kinds of activity. It would be helpful through the process that we're going through here to think about whether a more defined public comments are asked for. Question 1, question 2, question 3. If you want to have a general rant about life, then go somewhere else, but do answer question 1, question 2, question 3, not dissimilar to the public comment process that we had for the initial report, which asks very specific targeted questions about, for example, thinking about selection criteria that do blah, do you have anything further to add? Now, that yielded, in this case, quite detailed and useful material that we're considering now. So perhaps when we get to this, we improve our public comment processes so that they fit the purpose.
And as you probably know, I lean in that direction. Have in the past, and it's probably more important with this particular issue because of the fact that people are going to have such a wide, diverse range of reasons why a particular TLD should not be introduced, and we need to really get them to zero into the criteria that we ultimately establish for that rather than their own opinions that could cover anything.
That's right, yeah.
I remember quite painfully going through this process in 2000 and finding that one of the unstated evaluation criteria was that you had to be able to pronounce .iii. And, this was after the $50,000 application fee and all the time and money, and being the eighth TLD in the basket to be kicked out at the end because Mike Roberts couldn't pronounce it.
Yeah. That's right. So then the criteria.
Yeah. I think you want it all clearly stated, so the public comments that are coming in are coming in against stated criteria.
Somehow links to the question we had yesterday, if can we only have a Boolean criteria, either this TLD can exist or not exist, I believe it's a little bit more complicated than that. There may be strings that are fully okay, they should exist, but stuff, because only if certain requirements are met. And so it shouldn't just be a Boolean decision, you know, whether yes or no we should proceed. But what those requirements are, in, you know, by categories would be pretty, you know, it could be defined in a guideline document that could be published so people wouldn't have to go before an expert panel and slowly accumulate some, how to say, jurisprudence about what is okay, what is not okay. It is possible for certain categories of an NCO, and we would expect the following if the TOD is requested for that.
I think that, I don't know if you're on the same track that I am, but it sounds your close learner, and that is that I think we do need to beef up the objective criteria associated with this so that it is, the expectations are pretty well communicated in advance, and hopefully that will minimize, you know, submission of things that really wouldn't fit those, but also users should have a good idea of what's going to be evaluated.
Yeah, just to remind you, well, yesterday we are, and this is emphasizing the point about focused public comment period or focused selection or whatever, we were talking about the fact that this string should not be introduced at all by anybody, not this string should not be introduced by that applicant, because that is an important consideration.
My question is whether, after yesterday's discussion, the conclusion was that I'm the only member of the task force who's worried that the dispute resolution process is limited in terms of legal standing to existing registries. And if that was the case, if we would then move on and say, okay, well, to be able to group concludes that this is only open to registries, then I think that would put a lot more emphasis on the initial process of the public comments and then...
Yeah, which is what we're doing now, yeah.
It's of interest to really have a way of making that you not only heard, but also recognize and fed into the process.
Yeah. So that's essentially what we're doing also. So the dispute resolution process in Part C is more along the lines of what you just described there in terms of having legal standing, whereas this process is for anyone to raise an issue, but they have to raise an issue in the context of the criteria. They can't just say, I don't like that person because... You know, he's got views that differ from mine or something, you know. It has to be based on what the criteria are.
Yeah, my last question would be, is that going to be something very similar to this for conflicting trademark interests? Now we're looking at the interest of registries versus the applicant, but is there going to be another approach that would be like this that we're going to think about in the future?
If you're talking about trademarks, I would have thought, and that's a fair comment, if it's a trademark issue, I would hope that we could perhaps deal with that under a UDRP type process.
No.
No?
No. UDRP is after the fact. And so I intended for this to apply to the original proposal of the string. So let's say that, let's use Microsoft as an example. Let's say that MKade applied for Microsoft. Microsoft has a trademark, MK doesn't on the word Microsoft. That ought to be an easy staff determination of, you know, is this a recognizable name? That's going to get complicated because there are a lot of trademark names that are not recognizable. But I don't think you can deal with that. Bruce. Yeah. AGP, AT&T is a common law trademark. Right. It's recognized in a number of countries. So the little, but it's also trademark. I know, But on the issue of the UDRP, that's after the fact. You'd have to, so if you did it after the fact, you would have spent a lot of money going through the application process, building the proposal, and then you would be putting, and the registrant is probably by now engaged in a trademark court near you, or me, or wherever.
Let's just take that one off.
Okay, that's not that's what I was intending to address, not just the confusion of a string. So when I asked the clarification, I think I was in the same space that Issa is.
One of the criteria could be that you don't infringe the intellectual property rights of others, which is a criteria for registering a second level domain name at the moment. And so therefore you're making a public comment and say, this is infringing my trademark and here's the evidence of that trademark, that presumably could be addressed under that category. Okay, any other comments just on this process bit, and then we'll move on to the other issues.
If you're about to propose for a top-level domain, you're checking those things. So it's not that suddenly there's a trademark out there. You're checking it up front. I think so. I hope.
Yeah, you may not say it's checking it up front.
Yeah, if you're the one who's proposing for a top-level domain, you're checking it. You're not proposing AT&T and then suddenly, oh, there's a trademark AT&T. I didn't use it.
Yeah, you would hope that, but this is also a process of selection.
That's right,
that's why you need that. Which is why in trademarks you have that challenge process, shouldn't you? Yeah.
So we're assuming that the party who has the trademark presents the evidence, and that, again, you make it into the, had the company in Poland had the opportunity to be challenged by AT&T, then they would have been working it out either through mutual agreement or through in a trademark court. So, there will be conflicting trademark claims.
Yes,
but generally, it's possible to determine that someone has more standing, et cetera, et cetera. And that's where you may have to get into a panel again.
But it's not determined the more standing.
In granting a trademark, the trademark authorities do determine that based on demonstrated use.
Not from the trademark. Mm-hmm.
I've been trying to avoid comments, and we could go down like a three-hour rabbit hole of talking about trademarks. But I think it's really
3 hours.
Just even without talking about competing claims, if you try to vet all possible claims against all trademarks, you're going to run into all kinds of trouble. Like just off the top of my head, we gave out .biz a few years ago, but there's Biz Laundry Soap. So I'm sure they have this guy who did the laundry detergent called Biz Laundry Soap, part of the trademark in Biz. And should we have not given out .biz because of that conflicting trademark claim, or should we have only given out Biz to the adding it to the soap, and probably somebody else makes cars or something else in some other country, and now you share that same trademark, and it's just, my flag is that it's all very complicated.
Bruce, may I just add one more complication, and I'm sorry to do it here again. I just want to be absolutely sure that when you're referring to a public comment, you include members of the public and registered stakeholders in this accommodating process, not ICANN's 40 organizations and advisory councils. Are they? Yes, I know, it's public, small p public, but when we do a big p public comment period, I'm assuming that there is some other element here for consultation with other 40 organizations in a more formal way that is specific, because in the past we've had a problem where a public comment, well, we're not the public, we are ICANN supporting organization, ICANN advisory committee XYZ, we wish to be treated differently and more formally. So just for clarification, I want to make sure that in this case you mean general public comment period, not to anyone. Fine, thank you.
But I'd like to raise an issue in that regard. If you start separating that, especially with specific issues like this, you're going to drag out the application process even further. And one of the things that I think we all agreed on in this committee is that we really need to streamline that process. So I think we better think about that a little bit.
Because we're going in sorts of tangents here. This is public comment, then public comment. Now, it's a fixed process. The string is advertised, other issue in the story. It doesn't mean it's a genocide policy process if that's what you're fixing. It's not pretty string or anything like that. It's just purely public comment, the same way we've had public comments on RFPs or public comments on anything else.
It's not restricted to just the public, a constituency.
Absolutely.
Comment. That's what I wanted to clarify. Because if you separate that, and if that's, okay.
No, it's public in the sense of unconstrained as opposed to constrained might be we're doing a constituency comment period or something. It's not constrained. Everything, Tom?
The question came up yesterday of how one gets the GAC's opinion. And the GAC doesn't seem to be able to respond without an invitation. So should it be public comment plus GAC? I'm just, how do you deal with that? In other words, they don't see themselves as the public.
And in a timely way.
So does there need to be some accounting for, you know?
Well, I think what we discussed yesterday was that our next step on that front was that we'd make a recommendation in this report that we seek the GAC's advice on a process. And let's let them come back with a process first rather than asking them on an individual DOE basis.
But I'm wondering whether it might be sort of reasonable to suggest a process and ask them to comment or recommend alternatives as opposed to leaving it open to the GAC coming up with its own imagination of what a process that they like would be.
I think, so the GAC is, and Carolyn Kate speaking, the GAC has a subcommittee that is working on principles for GTLD policy, and they expect to come together on plenary in December. We may or may not see them at the council level before then, given what goes on within some governments who think that all decisions are sovereign. If we go back to how the CCs worked on this, it's reasonable to think that we could put forward ideas, it's probably also reasonable to think that at the end of the day they may want to modify those ideas. Yeah,
that was pretty much exactly my point, is not leave it an empty sheet, but basically put out ideas, and of course that they'll comment and modify and whatever. I just sort of uneasy about an empty sheet. Jack, tell us what you would like.
Pretty the word voice sensing. I think there's two things there. One is comment on the selection criteria, and the other is this sort of part of the process. So the GAC may well decide to introduce a selection criteria, just using an example, that it can't be a country name, right? So that's just a straight objective criteria to start, look up the list of country names, is it on that list, no, it's okay. So the GAC might have input on creating that selection criteria. You might have a selection criteria that's more general than a straight list of names. A selection criteria might be that the GAC puts forward that it's is not related to a special place name or something, some very general comment that they have as their selection criteria policy. Because we won't know what a special place is, it's not a defined list, then you have to have a comment process for the GAC to raise those things that they consider to be special. And we had a few examples yesterday, and you know, there was one that was got Hitler, and the Australian context has got Anzac and so on. Now, I wouldn't expect ICANN to have some exhaustive list of those things, but they may say, we want the opportunity to object if a name has some special significance to us. So that's just kind of separating those two things.
And that's what I meant in that public comment that's commenting on the string, which we've asked the public to comment, whether it's trademark, whether it's this, whether it's that, to also ask them, to also ask the GAC specifically that they, as a GAC, respond to the string at that specific time, because they need specific invitation to be able to.
How governments can respond, that's going to need to be governments as individuals, right? Because the GAC, to make a decision in plenary, and it is a government individually who will probably object. For instance, the President of China, the government of China might prefer not to have his name or her name, whatever it is, chosen. That may not be, so I do think you're right that we need to be thinking about what a exceptions approach is, or a protest approach is, and make an invitation to the GAC to comment. Just as we would probably send this notice to the other, to the CCNSO.
Mm-hmm. The one thing, I guess, and this is probably a side that concerns me, is one country objecting should not have the weight of the GAC objecting. In other words, there'll be a country that will object to almost any name. In some cases, you may need to deal with that. In some cases, it becomes problematic. And what I'm looking for is a way to sort of say, it's the GAC as a whole needs to be able to object to something for really to have GAC weight. Otherwise, a country's objection is the same as a company's objection, or even an individual's objection, because there is a GAC in which they can impress their own weight.
I'd like to challenge that in the following, with the following question. When you look at the bylaws, which I did last night, the GAC is responsible for public policy. We're responsible for policy. So the nexus between what is public policy and what is policy is something we've been fortunate inside ICANN today to pretty much be able to say this is policy about the technical functions that the GNSO is responsible for. So we're just beginning to hear from the GAC as it is maturing in its processes and as we're maturing in policy development about where they think they need to provide advice. Governments are sovereign within their national jurisdiction, and they have certain authorities that are agreed to at international levels. Advice doesn't necessarily mean dictating the outcome, right? But it is advice. I'm not so concerned that governments will object to every name, because I think, in fact, they won't object to every name. They're more likely to object to certain names that they consider inappropriate and to place some country names. And then the question may come of can we develop an exceptions policy to get agreement for place and country names to which there's no reasonable objection.
I do think that augurs on to an area that's really important for us to nail down a little bit, and I realize we can't just nail down what the GAC's going to do, but I hope we'll come back to this later, because in the registry decisions we did start talking about this and actually made some at least high-level suggestions in the input that we put forward for this committee meeting today, that I think it will be good, and I'll leave it at that right now, assuming that we'll come back to it later, because I know that Tom's been waiting to make a comment.
Well, yes, one of my clarifications is at what point in the process do you envision to take that point, actually? And I'm wondering, is it going to be a process for every TLD, and how does it refer to the application fee? I mean, it's always a question. I mean, if you just put the TLD string up from the application, is that going to happen every time if it's been obvious and it's not infringing anything? Or?
The question is
how you determine whether it's obvious. So I think what
we were talking about is there's an initial phase which might be the start confirming that there is an issue, and therefore the, you don't go any further. So someone basically puts forward an application for dot museum spelled slightly differently, and they didn't even know dot museum existed. And you go, well, did you know about dot museum? Oh, I didn't know that. So that gets dealt with straight away. Versus someone puts up a string called .xyz, and it doesn't seem to be anything obvious, but you do put it out in public comment to elicit input from people that suddenly go, wait, I've got a trademark on .xyz, and then there's a process there. But it's got to have a tight time frame to it as well.
Bruce, it may be useful to be clear as to the categories of objections we're talking about here. Now, we just started off, and I thought we're hoping to close on confusingly similar. Yeah. Now, exactly. So I think, if we close it there, because the conversation's already drifted into the other issues, which I think essentially are public morality, bad words, the dot Hitlers, etc., this world. And the next category, the technical, and the next category is reputational, which covers the country names, geographical names, and trademark issues. So you've got those things, which is objections in terms of use, but other people might think they deserve them, as opposed to simply those names should not exist at all.
Bruce,
yeah.
I just want to clarify, have you agreed to leave out any criteria related to the purpose? Similar only typographical.
Yeah, but what we need to understand is what are the other criteria in that sense, okay? So we've got the one, and we're dealing with the process, the one Dan is suggesting that we should create a process, just the one that doesn't apply to others. But what we agreed to yesterday was to go in streams, what we usually similar to existing previous things. And then we're saying there's a process that people do complain about that. Public can say, gee, I don't want that string, it's not like confusing me. And then they have to give whatever respond to the criteria. And then we're saying there's also a mechanism after the decision's been made that an existing registry operator can challenge the decision by the staff regarding whether or not the string is confusing or not. So this is just a step we had around the people who need simple.
Yeah, just to talk about this, if you check on something after the fact and there's already a registration mistaken, what is going to happen with that?
This is part of it.
Now, Bruce, are you looking for more ideas in terms of the confusing and similar category now, more specifics, or is that coming later?
We're dealing with differentiated names, the concept of differentiation. And that's what the discussion was yesterday, and we narrowed it down to one area that we can get room on, which is confusingly similar concept. Did you want to elaborate more on confusingly similar?
Sure. Yeah, and in fact, it was in our consensus statement way back at the beginning of the year. And you've already covered, I think, typo squatting, that particular area. But a transliteration of it or a lexical or semantical equivalent were two categories that we had suggested be in there. And, of course, obviously that relates to the IDN area. I think those are certainly confusingly similar. Okay. Yeah, so let's, I'm curious, We're not there yet. I thought we were looking at what's...
No, we're not there yet in the sense of agreeing some of those other points you've made. That's what we want to kind of start putting those on the table and get a sense of is there agreement. So there's agreement on this aspect being there's a likelihood of confusion on the part of the relevant public. And type of squatting was kind of the stuff that was most talked about. Those visual stuff. And we're giving examples, Chuck, yesterday. We're using language ones and you missed some of that discussion. Here's some of the stuff we're talking about. So, there's still a strong agreement that .co.m would be confusingly similar to .com. Then we're talking about .jobs, and we're saying, well, labour would not be confusingly similar to .jobs, that they look completely different. And then we talked about the issue of language, and we're saying that Arbeit, being German, is not confusingly similar to .jobs at the string level either. In other words, they don't look the same. I'm not going to get confused to accidentally type in .Arbeit instead of .jobs. They look completely different. But they do... they do mean this, potentially could mean the same. Semantically they're the same. They both mean jobs. One happens to be jobs in German, one happens to be jobs in English. So that was the discussion we had around what was confusingly similar. Now what we're...
And when you're saying confusingly similar, then are you restricting that just to the entering of the TLD? Are you leaving out semantical considerations?
So far, yes. But what we're about to talk about is those other issues, yes.
Okay.
So, Chuck, what I'm trying to do is identify where the areas of consensus are, and I do know there are proposals to make it much broader. But yesterday, this was kind of what we were agreeing was the stuff that we thought were confusingly similar, and we got down to that definition.
So we're only focusing on areas where we already have agreement. We're not evaluating new possible areas. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, we're about to this morning, yeah. Chuck, we're in the general recapping again. Yesterday we're talking about the wording we currently have around differentiating the stream based on purpose did not get much support in the public comment process. And a number of constituencies have also expressed concern about that current wording. Then we said, okay, well, let's start with what we can all agree on, and this is what we can all agree on, is on the confusingly similar string stuff on the typographic side of things. And then I'm just trying to recap where we were yesterday. We've now gone into a rat hole around the process for that, which is okay, that adds value. So that's the new content that's been created today. But we also wanted to go back to where we finished yesterday into the other areas that you're talking about. And that is, what are some of the other dimensions? We talked about, and this is back up on the screen, this is where we were yesterday, which is to say, what about issues of language and scripts? What about issues of markets and purpose? So we're saying, should Arbeit, because it's the same purpose of jobs, should that not be allowed? If .jobs is in Chinese characters, should that not be allowed? And we're talking about markets and purpose. If the purpose of the market is currently to address the commercial registrants or something, you create a string called .xyz, and the purpose of .xyz is exactly the same purpose as com, should or should not that be allowed? So we're just trying to, that's the discussion we're about to have this morning. And then some of the other ones people have suggested is trademark infringement, I guess. And what was the other one that you had there, Dan, technical?
Yes.
So trademark infringement, EG, or .microsoft. Someone put forward .microsoft.
It's sort of about a reputation. Reputation is not a term that I'm...
Well, what I'm saying
in terms of the four categories for exclusion, you would have a potentially similar mechanism for reputational objection, which is trademark infringement or country names.
Place names, country names, city names.
Yeah.
You're putting that in the category of reputational?
Yeah.
Is that because that's trademark language?
I think there are similarities. Yes, I mean, a country is going to feel that it has a certain right to France. Feels it has a right to the name France because the country France exists. It has a reputation. It has, you know, etc. It's the same flavor of objection, because it's not to say saying. No one, it's not saying as confusing someone that no one should have this name, this name should not exist. It may be those guys shouldn't have this name, but that others might.
I think the reason I would suggest separating them, Philip, is that the influence or participation of governments in one set of names is going to, I think, be different than another set of names. So I'm just hoping to sort of...
We may need to subdivide them. I'm just trying to get down in terms of where we are. And I think the first thing you might want to cover, Bruce, would be the technical objection, because I think that's also this name should not be used by anybody at all, isn't it? And the public morality objection is also a less easy one. But the public morality objection is also this name should not be used by anyone at all. Category, yeah. And then you get into other categories of this name cannot be used by them, but maybe I want it. But let's do that later, because that's more difficult.
So the categories that I'm hearing, so just trying to catalog these for the moment. The categories where there might be an objection is, one is semantically, this is basically in the category of semantically the same one, just... and we're using jobs as an example here, jobs and other jobs in Chinese characters. This deals with language and script, so it can be semantically the same but in a different language, still using the ASCII characters, or it could use different scripts using the IBM mechanism and mean the same thing. Then we talked about markets and purpose, so you could say that the purpose of the string, and we're using the example of XXX yesterday, XXX on its own doesn't really mean anything, but the purpose is for a particular purpose. So if XXX did happen to exist for the purposes of pornography, then you would say, okay, well, we're not going to allow adult porn because it's not semantically the same, but the purpose is the same. And then we had trademark infringement, country names, technical. So in these, I'm assuming that most people would agree on the technical type of scenario. So, you know, we need to take into account a .ampersand or a .exe. Country names, I think we leave to gaps at all.
A new TRB question you posted like a year ago that has all these different questions, controversial, political, cultural, religious terms, so dot God, dot Allah, obscenities.
Yes.
So what controversial terms? Political / cultural / religious.
Controversial, political,
cultural. What else? Religious. Sense. Beyond just country names, you've got geographical terms.
What do you regard as a country name, for example?
In what language?
For example, the Provence is a part of France, you know, it's part of the question you get as well, and talking about cities, stuff like that.
Also, depending on how broad you cast the trademark infringement, there are personal names, pharmaceutical names.
I have a question. When people do geographical names, do they do them in any language? For example, I understand why Deutschland or whatever might be protected, but would Germany also be?
would Tedeschi in Italian be?
I think the community would choose their own language because the 99% of the users are in this community.
Jesus might, but maybe not the government. So you never know what can want to happen if you will. It's totally impossible to tell in front.
But they might also want to choose more than one language, like the Dutchlands. Okay, but because maybe English is more used in the internet community, they would like to choose also German.
Some of the categories that were just mentioned seem to be covered by trademark. Wouldn't pharmaceutical names, for example, be covered? That would come under the trademark area, would it not?
Pharmaceuticals might, but indigenous plants and other treatments that a country considers. But I have a question for all of us. We're spending a lot of time on exceptions, and particularly exceptions that we might not be able to resolve.
I disagree. Okay. We're looking at some categories here. I'm just giving examples of them. But it's getting a sense of, one of the core issues that is going to be an issue is choice of stream. And you've got two kind of categories of those issues. One of those issues relating to a clash between that stream and an existing stream. Okay, and that's kind of where the registries are starting from. And that was, I think, more or less where we were getting to with that current recommendation around differentiation of streams. And the current wording was talking about differentiation of purpose, which has a lot of different meanings to people. And I think the sense was from the public comment process that was passed too broadly. And so we've narrowed it down now, which is too confusingly similar. Now what we're saying is, do we want to then widen that some more? This is around the clash between an existing TLD. Then we're looking at another category which is not relating to a clash with an existing TLD, but a clash with a name that has meaning to someone. Now, whether it's a trademark, whether it's a country name, whether it's an offensive term or whatever, the question is, whether it's technical, what are our processes for dealing with that? I think technical is probably pretty straightforward. I think that process we talked about can deal with that. Someone raises a technical issue, it's evaluated by appropriate experts. So that's probably handled by that process we just came up with.
Can that not be even easier with the creation of a list? Is that not feasible? Yeah.
Well, creation of any list, Phil, still has the issue that you don't always get it right. I mean, you can... I think you can have a list of examples, but...
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I think having the doctor localhost gives people an idea, but I don't think you'd make that... If it's not on that list, it's fine. I think you still have that public comment process that allows people to... What I suggest we do, actually, is we've got more than two. We've got... Yeah, just have a bit of a break. I just got a sense of going over the place here. I do want to just focus... What I suggest we do is, as our next topic, let's focus still on the clash with existing TLDs first, and then widen it to the other categories, which is the sort of trademarks and others, because they are quite separate issues. One is to say we've got a set of existing TLDs, and someone's proposing a new stream. What restrictions are we going to impose on adding those new streams? And then the other category is really nothing to do with existing TLDs. It's saying, someone proposes .Microsoft and I have a trademark for that, it's a problem. Someone proposes .Hitler, this part of the world is not going to like that. How are we going to address those issues? So that's a completely separate category, I think.
Chris, just a suggestion, you can take it or leave it, but wouldn't it be helpful if we articulated what the goals of differentiation are, and then we can base our ongoing work on those goals? I don't think that's very hard to do.
I think that's fair, and this is again differentiation with respect to an existing TLD.
Well, I don't know that it really matters whether it's existing or future, because the same principles will come into play, except that we can't go back and retroactively change things.
Just clarify what you meant by future.
Well, the same issues are going to come. Let's say you have a round of 10 new TLDs. There may be some of these issues that relate to those.
as well. Not only there may be user confusion with regard to two new ones rather than a new one, and that's probably part of the allocation as well. So then you're talking about
first come first serve.
I mean, that's okay if we treat them separately. I think the principles are basically the same.
Yeah. All I meant by the existing TLD is I just meant that there's a clash with those TLD as opposed to a clash with something that's not a TLD. So if I'm introducing Microsoft, I'm actually clashing with something that's outside of it. Yeah. Okay, so let's break for 10 minutes. And then the next discussion, we'll come back to this differentiation of TLD first, and then we can talk about the other issues of streams, which is trademarks and other things.
I have a friend who is certain that we can find the new best routing protocol using string theory, and that basically the application of string theory to the patch that you find in the network. And he's working on it. He's working on it in the routing research. I don't understand this statement.